There are two parts to the reading this morning. The first is taken from Genesis chapter 12, and this can be found on page 13 of the Church Bibles. And the second part is 1 Peter 2, and that can be found on page 1218. Genesis 12, starting to read at verse 1. The call of Abram. The Lord had said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." 1 Peter 2. The living stone and a chosen people. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now, to you who believe, this stone is precious, but those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." This is the word of the Lord.
Morning, everyone. Good to see you. Add my welcome. Even though it's snowing, lots of people in church and not throwing snowballs at each other, which makes me happy. A story. An anthropologist was doing some work in Africa, and as part of his work, he suggested a game to a group of children. And he put a basket of fruit by a tree, and he told this group of children that whoever got to the basket of fruit first, they could have all the fruit. So he got them all ready, tried to make it fair, equal distance apart around the tree, and he set it up as a race. So, of course, started ready, steady, go. But what happened next was not what he expected. Because rather than the really lean, fast child pegging it to the middle and getting the basket of fruit, which was a big treat, the children all held hands and went in at the same pace together. And a few seconds later, they were all sitting, eating some of the fruit with the juice dripping down their chins. The man asked them, why did they run like that? Why did they do it like that? When actually the fastest one, he thought he'd picked out who the fastest one might be, why he didn't run and have all the fruit for himself. The children simply said they couldn't understand how any of them could be happy if one or two of them were going to be with the fruit and everyone else was going to be sad. It didn't seem to work for them. The story is based on an African philosophy of Ubuntu. It's not an open source software system, as some of you will immediately have thought. That's a mild laugh. Some people still haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. That's fine. It's actually Ubuntu, that IT system, has borrowed the name from African philosophy. And across cultures, Ubuntu is this idea of humanity towards others. It's a belief in some kind of universal bond of sharing that connects all of humanity. It suggests that our very humanity is a quality which we owe to each other. Our humanity is not ours to keep to ourselves. In the sharing of ourselves, we give humanity to other people and we receive it in return. By ourselves, this philosophy suggests, we cannot be fully human. The idea of Ubuntu became a rich theme, I don't know if you remember this, in the reconciliation process after apartheid in South Africa. And it was couched, actually, in quite Christian terms. And I think they were onto something. In 1999, Archbishop Desmond Tutu wrote No Future Without Forgiveness. It's a real landmark book. And in it, he wrote this. A person with Ubuntu is open and available to others, affirming of others, doesn't feel threatened that others are able and good, based from a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are humiliated or diminished, when others are tortured or oppressed. And later on, he goes on to expand. We think of ourselves far too frequently as just individuals separated from one another. In fact, you are connected, and what you do affects the whole world. When you do it well, it spreads out. It's for the whole of humanity. And I think it was really profound, actually, at the memorial service, the funeral for Nelson Mandela. President Barack Obama said this. There's a word in South Africa, Ubuntu, and it captures Mandela's greatest gift, his recognition that we are all bound together in ways that are invisible to the eye, that there is a oneness to humanity, that we achieve ourselves by sharing ourselves with others and caring for those around us. Just for a moment, I want you to dream a dream. Imagine that every single person, every man, woman, and child on the whole face of the earth practiced this philosophy. Everybody had such a deep-rooted respect for humanity, such an earthy understanding of every single person's value, that we took for granted that every single human being was essential to be other, to be accepted and celebrated. What would it look like? What would that look like in Syria? What would that look like in northern Iraq or the Democratic Republic of Congo or North Korea? What would it look like in our schools, in our hospitals? What would it look like in the road, on the road in rush hour, Reigate Hill? If you can dream that dream of how life would be different, if you can catch a vision where everybody loves and respects each other, well, I suggest that's a really good place to start our prayers, because I believe that is the final dream of what God created. That when humanity had this idea of mutual respect and mutual value, mutual love, we will get somewhere near to that beautiful perfection that God designed. But for now, it's a great place to start how we live life, because this ancient idea of mutual humanity, of community, of the value placed on the whole rather than selected individuals, is deeply, deeply Christian and deeply, deeply godly. Tom Wright says this, "We've been so soaked in the individualism of modern Western culture that we can feel threatened by the idea of our primary identity being that of the family we belong to, especially when that family is so large, stretching across space and time. The church isn't simply a collection of isolated individuals all following their own pathways of spiritual growth without much reference to one another." And some of us might find that difficult to accept, that our identity is totally caught up in our community, in our relationships. As Tom Wright says, Western society and culture is absolutely bound up in individualism. My needs, my choices, my desires, my freedoms, my rights, my sexuality, my bank balance, my kitchen, my skills. We have to be so careful that the language of the church, the language of Christian community, speaks so much more in terms of we, us, and ours than it does of I, me, and mine. Way back in Genesis, before our reading, way back in the creation account, we hear for the first time that God himself is a community, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Genesis 1:26, God says, "Let us make man in our image." God describes himself as plural. The very nature of God is one of community, one of relationship defined by love. And as we go on through the Bible and through the early church, that develops into the idea of Trinity, God in three persons. I'm not going to quite unpack that this morning. I'll leave that for another day and somebody else. But it's not a surprise when in the second creation account, there's two versions of it in those first few chapters, God says of Adam, these are key words, "It is not good for the man to be alone." It's not good for the man to be alone. And I nearly stepped into all kinds of jokes about how men can't cope on their own, but I chose not to. But God goes on to make Eve the woman. It's not surprising at all, because if we're made in the image of God, we too are creatures of community at our very heart. God is community and we are designed to be community. We are creatures made to be in relationship, a direct relationship with God and in a profound relationship with the whole of humanity. It's the very core of our design. And it wasn't just that Adam was having a grumpy day and needed cheering up. Fundamentally, it's not good for any of us to be alone. Not for a long time. We are designed to be in relationship. So if we're designed to be in community, in relationship, what is it that binds us together? What are the family likenesses? What's the DNA that we all share? Well, a great place to start is that enigmatic promise that we heard from God to Abraham at the beginning of Genesis 12. God promises Abraham great blessing. And then at the end of verse 3, he says, "All peoples will be blessed through you." Abraham, all peoples will be blessed through you. Now, that word peoples, it's one of my favorite words in the whole Bible. It's the kind of word that makes you smile by just saying it, and I might have mentioned this once before. The Hebrew word is this, mishpachor. If ever you watched Ivor the Engine, and it goes, I can't remember what the sound was, but I now have mishpachor, 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 which is like the steam engine noise going along, and it makes me smile. Sorry, I just thought you have a window into my world there. This Hebrew word, mishpachor, is a fabulous, richly dripping with meaning word that kind of translates into household. Now, household is a very normal word in our language, isn't it? You think of cleaning products or that aisle in the supermarket. Household has this rich idea, and perhaps the nearest translatable concept is extended family, as opposed to nuclear family. There's another Hebrew word which means house, bahith, which is kind of nuclear parents and children kind of family. But mishpachor means pretty much anybody who you might be distantly related to. The idea of wider family, all those cousins six times removed, great ancient aunts and many, many grandchildren for whom the whole household takes responsibility, but everyone enjoys too. A cornucopia of colourful family life across generations. Who is your mishpachor? Who is your household? If you're anything like me, you might be able to relate literally to this concept. My dad was a Southern Irish Catholic from a big family. I have six cousins, eight second cousins, and then a load more. I'm not really sure what the exact relationships are, but all I know is at Christmas we had to find the biggest house going, and whether you were first cousins or 26th cousins, it didn't really matter. We just went in eight lots and had fun. And there were often 50 or 60 people in the house, most of whom were blood relatives with each other, however distantly. At our wedding, Simon and I had to work out our guest list. And from his family, there were 12 people. And from my family, there were 70 people. And so I didn't get to choose so many friends to come to our wedding. One of my cousins married another Catholic guy. That happens a lot. He had 11 brothers and sisters, and there was only one venue, which included a cricket pitch, which we could use for the party afterwards. Celebration of two mishpachors coming together. But I want to suggest to you this morning that our mishpachor is much wider than that. Because we have blood relatives across the globe, billions of them, in Sri Lanka, all over the place. Because when we come to faith in Jesus, when we declare that he is king, when we submit ourselves to him, we join the most enormous, the most amazing, the most vibrant mishpachor, the most vibrant household, family, a community defined by its blood relationships. But of course, in this instance, the blood is not the blood that flows through our veins. It's the blood that Jesus spilt for every single one of us. We're blood relatives in quite a different way. But nonetheless, we are family. We're a household blessed by God through Abraham and united by Christ. Another cornucopia of colourful family life across cultures, generations, and even across history. When Peter wrote the letter that we heard from this morning, he was writing most likely to a scattered group of Christians with both Jewish and Gentile backgrounds. They were under persecution from Nero. It was around the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, probably just slightly before. And so they had fled all over the Middle East and Asia Minor. And so Peter, with his heart breaking to see his family dispersed like this, writes to them and reminds them, "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." Peter says, "You might now be scattered across the world. You might be divided by culture, by race, by nationality. But you remain a chosen people, a holy nation, one family. What unites you is so much stronger than what divides you. You're still blood relatives." St. Mary's, we are mishpachor on a small scale. Those of us who express a faith in Jesus and follow him, we are blood relatives. And what's more, we're blood relatives across the globe with all others who have the same faith. And we're recipients of that ancient promise through Abraham. So what? Why does it matter? Why is it important that we identify ourselves as God's people in relationship with him and with one another? Well, this week has been a case in point. I don't know if it's just people who work for the church that take notice of what's been going on in the news, but it has been splashed across the media. The Anglican Communion has seen challenging days this week. I'm not going to get sidetracked this morning about issues of human sexuality, because believe it or not, the meeting in Canterbury wasn't about that. Indirectly, it was needed because of that, but that wasn't the subject. The meeting was about relationship. Difficult questions of how we sustain relationships with those with whom we disagree. My social media feed this week has been full of comment and reaction, strong reaction. And at times, honestly, some of it has made me weep. The strength of feeling on all sides of this debate is so palpable. But here's the thing. We have been known this week for what divides us. That's too often the case, isn't it? Whether on a global scale like the Anglican primates, or whether on a national level, or whether the differences between Christian denominations, or whether we disagree over what sort of coffee we should serve after the morning service, we are often known for what divides us. And so this morning, I think the challenge for us is to have at the center of our hearts, our minds, our priorities, this concept of mishpachor. We are family, a family blessed by Abraham, through Abraham, by God. We're united by the life, death, and resurrection, the saving grace of Jesus Christ. we're blood relatives, and there is so much more that unites us than divides us, because blood runs thicker than water. And so I want to encourage you this morning. All families have disagreements. Ours is no exception, whether that's mine in my small house or us as a household. But all I ask of you is this. If you need to disagree with somebody on something, we will do that. That's all right. Especially if you feel strongly about it. I ask you this. Before giving breath and energy to your disagreement, will you give acknowledgement either in your head, in your heart, or even out loud of all that it is that unites you? That the person that you speak with or the group of people you write to are your blood relatives. So much more that unites than divides. We're on the same team. We're in relationship with God and with each other, and that connection is deeply wired into us as our identity as sons and daughters of God, bought at a price through Jesus. I quoted earlier from Tom Wright. It's his book, Simply Christian, which I recommend to you if you haven't read. And I'm going to continue on with that quote, and after that, I'm going to pray, and we'll pray together. So he carries on with this. According to the early Christians, the church doesn't exist in order to provide a place where people can pursue private spiritual agendas or develop their own spiritual potential. Nor does it exist in order to provide a safe haven in which people can hide from the wicked world and assure that they themselves arrive safely in heaven. Private spiritual growth and ultimate salvation come, but they come as the byproducts of the main, central, overarching purpose for which God has called and is calling us. This purpose is stated in various places clearly in the New Testament, that through the church, and we pray through this church, that through the church, God will announce to the wider world that he is indeed its wise, loving, and just creator. That through Jesus he has defeated the powers that corrupt and enslave it, and that by his Spirit he is at work to heal and renew it. The relationship that unites us is infinitely stronger than all that threatens to divide us. If you're able, shall we stand together and pray?